You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of the revised Michael Wilson translation of The Philosophy of Freedom, The Basis for a Modern World Conception, done during the 150th anniversary of Rudolf Steiner's birth. This is Chapter 9, entitled The Idea of Freedom. For our cognition, the concept of the tree is conditioned by the percept of the tree. When faced with a particular percept, I can select only one particular concept from the general system of concepts. The connection of concept and percept is determined by thinking, indirectly and objectively, at the level of the percept. This connection of the percept with its concept is recognized after the act of perceiving, but that they do belong together lies in the very nature of things. The process looks different when we examine knowledge, or rather the relation of man to the world that arises within knowledge. In the preceding chapters, the attempt has been made to show that an unprejudiced observation of this relationship is able to throw light on its nature. A proper understanding of this observation leads to the insight that thinking can be directly discerned as a self-contained entity. I'm going to read that sentence again. A proper understanding of this observation leads to the insight that thinking can be directly discerned as a self-contained entity. Those who find it necessary for the explanation of thinking as such to invoke something else, such as physical brain processes or unconscious spiritual processes lying behind the conscious thinking that they observe, fail to recognize what an unprejudiced observation of thinking yields. When we observe our thinking, we live during this observation directly within a self-supporting spiritual web of being. Indeed, we can even say that if we would grasp the essential nature of spirit in the form in which it presents itself most immediately to man, we need only look at the self-sustaining activity of thinking. When we are contemplating thinking itself, two things coincide which otherwise must always appear apart, namely concept and percept. If we fail to see this, we shall be unable to regard the concepts which we have elaborated with respect to percepts as anything but shadowy copies of these percepts, and we shall take the percepts as presenting to us the true reality. We shall, further, build up for ourselves a metaphysical world after the pattern of the perceived world. We shall call this a world of atoms, a world of will, a world of unconscious spirit, or whatever, each according to his own kind of mental imagery. And we shall fail to notice that all the time we have been doing nothing but building up a metaphysical world hypothetically after the pattern of our own world of percepts. But if we recognize what is present in thinking, we shall realize that in the percept we have only one part of the reality, and that the other part which belongs to it, and which first allows the full reality to appear, is experienced by us in the permeation of the percept by thinking. We shall see in this element that appears in our consciousness as thinking not a shadowy copy of some reality, but a self-sustaining spiritual essence. And of this we shall be able to say that it is brought into consciousness for us through intuition. Intuition is the conscious experience in pure spirit of a purely spiritual content. Only through an intuition can the essence of thinking be grasped. Only if, by means of unprejudiced observation, one has wrestled through to the recognition of this truth, of the intuitive essence of thinking, will one succeed in clearing the way for an insight into the psychophysical organization of man. One will see that this organization can have no effect on the essential nature of thinking. At first sight, this seems to be contradicted by patently obvious facts. For ordinary experience, human thinking makes its appearance only in connection with and by means of this organization. This form of its appearance comes so much to the fore that its real significance cannot be grasped unless we recognize that in the essence of thinking this organization plays no part whatever. Once we appreciate this, we can no longer fail to notice what a peculiar kind of relationship there is between the human organization and the thinking itself. For this organization contributes nothing to the essential nature of thinking, but recedes whenever the activity of thinking makes its appearance. It suspends its own activity. It yields ground, and on the ground thus left empty, the thinking appears. The essence that is active in thinking has a twofold function. First, it represses the activity of the human organization. Secondly, it steps into its place. For even the former, the repression of the physical organization is a consequence of the activity of thinking, and more particularly of that part of this activity which prepares the manifestation of thinking. From this, one can see in what sense thinking finds its counterpart in the physical organization. When we see this, we can no longer misjudge the significance of this counterpart of the activity of thinking. When we walk over soft ground, our feet leave impressions in the soil. We shall not be tempted to say that these footprints have been formed from below by the forces of the ground. We shall not attribute to these forces any share in the production of the footprints. Just as little, if we observe the essential nature of thinking without prejudice, shall we attribute any share in that nature to the traces in the physical organism which arise through the fact that the thinking prepares its manifestation by means of the body. An important question, however, emerges here. If the human organization has no part in the essential nature of thinking, what is the significance of this organization within the whole nature of man? Now, what happens in this organization through the thinking has indeed nothing to do with the essence of thinking, but it has a great deal to do with the arising of the ego consciousness out of this thinking. Thinking in its own essential nature certainly contains the real I or ego, but it does not contain the ego consciousness. To see this, we have but to observe thinking with an open mind. The I, capital, is to be found within the thinking. The, quote, ego consciousness, close quote, arises through the traces which the activity of thinking engraves upon our general consciousness, in the sense explained above. Parenthesis, the ego consciousness thus arises through the bodily organization. However, this must not be taken to imply that the ego consciousness, once it has arisen, remains dependent on the bodily organization. Once arisen, it is taken up into thinking and shares henceforth in thinking's spiritual being. Close parenthesis. The ego consciousness is built upon the human organization. Out of the latter flow our acts of will. Following the lines of the preceding argument, we can gain insight into the connections between thinking, conscious I, and act of will only by observing first how an act of will issues from the human organization. In any particular act of will, we must take into account the motive and the driving force. The motive is a factor with the character of a concept or a mental picture. The driving force is the will factor belonging to the human organization and directly conditioned by it. The conceptual factor, or motive, is the momentary determining factor of the will. The driving force is the permanent determining factor of the individual. A motive for the will may be a pure concept, or else a concept with a particular reference to a percept, that is, a mental picture. Both general concepts and individual ones, parenthesis, mental pictures, close parenthesis, become motives of will by affecting the human individual and determining him to action in a particular direction. But one and the same concept, or one and the same mental picture, affects different individuals differently. They stimulate different people to different actions. An act of will is, therefore, not merely the outcome of the concept or the mental picture, but also of the individual makeup of the person. Here we may well follow the example of Eduard von Hartmann and call this individual makeup the characterological disposition. The manner in which concept and mental picture affects the characterological disposition of a person, gives to his life a definite moral or ethical stamp. The characterological disposition is formed by the more or less permanent content of our subjective life, that is, by the content of our mental pictures and feelings. Whether a mental picture which enters my mind at this moment stimulates me to an act of will or not depends on how it relates itself to the content of all my other mental pictures and also to my idiosyncrasies of feeling. But after all, the general content of my mental pictures is itself conditioned by the sum total of those concepts which have, in the course of my individual life, come into contact with percepts, that is, have become mental pictures. This sum, again, depends on my greater or lesser capacity for intuition, and on the range of my observations, that is, on the subjective and objective factors of experience, on my inner nature and situation in life. My characterological disposition is determined especially by my life of feeling. Whether I shall make a particular mental picture or concept into a motive of action or not will depend on whether it gives me joy or pain. These are the elements which we have to consider in an act of will. The immediately present mental picture or concept, which becomes the motive, determines the aim or the purpose of my will. My characterological disposition determines me to direct my activity toward this aim. The mental picture of taking a walk in the next half hour determines the aim of my action. But this mental picture is raised to the level of a motive for my will only if it meets with a suitable characterological disposition. That is, if during my past life I have formed the mental pictures of the sense and purpose of taking a walk, of the value of health, and further, if the mental picture of taking a walk is accompanied in me by a feeling of pleasure. We must therefore distinguish, number one, the possible subjective dispositions, which are capable of turning certain mental pictures and concepts into motives, and number two, the possible mental pictures and concepts which are in a position to influence my characterological disposition so that an act of will results. For our moral life, the former represent the driving force and the latter its aims. The driving force in the moral life can be discovered by finding out the elements of which individual life is composed. The first level of individual life is that of perceiving, more particularly perceiving through the senses. This is the region of our individual life in which perceiving translates itself directly into willing, without the intervention of either a feeling or a concept. The driving force here involved is simply called instinct. The satisfaction of our lower purely animal needs, parenthesis hunger, sexual intercourse, etc., close parenthesis, comes about in this way. The main characteristic of instinctive life is the immediacy with which the single percept releases the act of will. This kind of determination of the will, which belongs originally only to the life of the lower senses, may, however, become extended also to the percepts of the higher senses. We may react to the percept of a certain event in the external world without reflecting on what we do, without any special feeling connecting itself with the percept, as in fact happens in our conventional social behavior. The driving force of such action is called tact, or moral good taste. The more often such immediate reactions to a percept occur, the more the person concerned will prove himself able to act purely under the guidance of tact. That is, tact becomes his characterological disposition. The second level of human life is feeling, definite feelings accompany the percepts of the external world. These feelings may become the driving force of an action. When I see a starving man, my pity for him may become the driving force of my action. Such feelings, for example, are shame, pride, sense of honor, humility, remorse, pity, revenge, gratitude, piety, loyalty, love, and duty. The third level of life amounts to thinking and forming mental pictures. A mental picture or a concept may become the motive of an action through mere reflection. Mental pictures become motives because in the course of life we regularly connect certain aims of our will with percepts which recur again and again in more or less modified form. Hence, with people not wholly devoid of experience, it happens that the occurrence of certain percepts is always accompanied by the appearance in consciousness of mental pictures of actions that they themselves have carried out in a similar case, or have seen others carry out. These mental pictures float before their minds as patterns which determine all subsequent decisions. They become parts of their characterological disposition. The driving force in the will, in this case, we can call practical experience. Practical experience merges gradually into purely tactful behavior. This happens when definite typical pictures of actions have become so firmly connected in our minds with mental pictures of certain situations in life, that in any given instance we skip over all deliberation based on experience and go straight from the percept to the act of will. The highest level of individual life is that of conceptual thinking, without regard to any definite perceptual content. We determine the content of our concept through pure intuition, from out of the ideal sphere. Such a concept contains, at first, no reference to any definite percepts. If we enter upon an act of will, under the influence of a concept which refers to a percept, that is, under the influence of a mental picture, then it is this percept which determines our action indirectly by way of the conceptual thinking. But if we act under the influence of intuitions, the driving force of our action is pure thinking. As it is the custom in philosophy to call the faculty of pure thinking, in quotes, reason. Let me read that again. As it is the custom in philosophy to call the faculty of pure thinking, in quotes, reason, we may well be justified in giving the name of practical reason to the moral driving force characteristic of this level of life. The clearest account of this driving force in the will has been given by Krehenbühl. In my opinion, his article on this subject is one of the most important contributions to present-day philosophy, more especially to ethics. Krehenbühl calls the driving force we are here discussing the practical a priori, that is, an impulse to action issuing directly from my intuition. It is clear that such an impulse can no longer be counted in the strictest sense as belonging to the characterological disposition. For what is here effective as the driving force is no longer something merely individual in me, but the ideal and hence universal content of my intuition. As soon as I see the justification for taking this content as the basis and starting point of an action, I enter upon the act of will irrespective of whether I have had the concept beforehand or whether it only enters my consciousness immediately before the action. That is, irrespective of whether it was already present as a disposition in me or not. Since a real act of will results only when a momentary impulse to action, in the form of a concept or mental picture, acts on the characterological disposition, such an impulse then becomes the motive of the will. The motives of moral conduct are mental pictures and concepts. There are moral philosophers who see a motive for moral behavior also in the feelings. They assert, for instance, that the aim of moral action is to promote the greatest possible quantity of pleasure for the acting individual. Pleasure itself, however, cannot become a motive. Only an imagined pleasure can. The mental picture of a future feeling, but not the feeling itself, can act on my characterological disposition. For the feeling itself does not yet exist in the moment of action. It has first to be produced by the action. The mental picture of one's own or another's welfare is, however, rightly regarded as a motive of the will. The principle of producing the greatest quantity of pleasure for oneself through one's action, that is, of attaining individual happiness, is called egoism. The attainment of this individual happiness is sought either by thinking ruthlessly only of one's own good and striving to attain it even at the cost of the happiness of other individuals, parenthesis, pure egoism, close parenthesis, or by promoting the good of others, either because one anticipates a favorable influence on one's own person indirectly through the happiness of others, or because one fears to endanger one's own interest by injuring others, parenthesis, morality of prudence, close parenthesis. The special content of the egoistical principles of morality will depend on the mental pictures which we form of what constitutes our own or others' happiness. A person will determine the content of his egoistical striving in accordance with what he regards as the good things of life, parenthesis, luxury, hope of happiness, deliverance from various evils, and so on, close parenthesis. The purely conceptual content of an action is to be regarded as yet another kind of motive. This content refers not to the particular action only, as with the mental picture of one's own pleasures, but to the derivation of an action from a system of moral principles. These moral principles, in the form of abstract concepts, may regulate the individual's moral life without his worrying himself about the origin of the concepts. In that case, we simply feel that submitting to a moral concept in the form of a commandment overshadowing our actions is a moral necessity. The establishment of this necessity we leave to those who demand moral subjection from us, that is, to the moral authority that we acknowledge, parenthesis, the head of the family, the state, social custom, the authority of the church, divine revelation, close parenthesis. It is a special kind of these moral principles when the commandment is made known to us not through an external authority, but through our own inner life, parenthesis, moral autonomy, close parenthesis. In this case, we hear in our own souls the voice to which we have to submit ourselves. This voice expresses itself as conscience. It is a moral advance when a person no longer simply accepts the commands of an outer or inner authority as the motive of his action, but tries to understand the reason why a particular maxim of behavior should act as a motive in him. This is the advance from morality based on authority to action out of moral insight. At this level of morality, a man will try to find out the requirements of the moral life and will let his actions be determined by the knowledge of them. Such requirements are, 1, the greatest possible good of mankind purely for its own sake. 2, the progress of civilization or the moral evolution of mankind toward ever greater perfection. 3, the realization of individual moral aims grasped by pure intuition. The greatest possible good of mankind will naturally be understood in different ways by different people. This maxim refers not to any particular mental picture of this, in quotes, good, but to the fact that everyone who acknowledges this principle strives to do whatever, in his opinion, most promotes the good of mankind. The progress of civilization, for those to whom the blessings of civilization bring a feeling of pleasure, turns out to be a special case of the foregoing moral principle. Of course, they will have to take into the bargain the decline and destruction of a number of things that also contribute to the general good. It is also possible, however, that some people regard the progress of civilization as a moral necessity, quite apart from the feeling of pleasure that it brings. For them, this becomes a special moral principle in regard to the previous one. The principle of the progress of civilization, like that of the general good, is based on a mental picture. That is, on the way we relate the content of our moral ideas to particular experiences, percepts. The highest conceivable moral principle, however, is one that from the start contains no such reference to particular experiences, but springs from the source of pure intuition, and only later seeks any reference to percepts, that is, to life. Here, the decision as to what is to be willed proceeds from an authority very different from that of the foregoing cases. If a person holds to the principle of the general good, he will, in all his actions, first ask what his ideals will contribute to this general good. If a person upholds the principle of the progress of civilization, he will act similarly. But there is a still higher way, which does not start from one and the same particular moral aim in each case, but sees a certain value in all moral principles, and always asks whether in the given case this or that principle is the most important. It may happen that in some circumstances a person considers the right aim to be the progress of civilization, in others the promotion of the general good, and in yet another the promotion of his own welfare, and in each case makes that the motive of his action. But if no other ground for decision claims more than second place, then conceptual intuition itself comes first and foremost into consideration. All other motives now give way, and the idea behind an action alone becomes its motive. Among the levels of characterological disposition, we have singled out as the highest the one that works as pure thinking or practical reason. Among the motives, we have just singled out conceptual intuition as the highest. On closer inspection, it will at once be seen that at this level of morality, driving force and motive coincide. That is, neither a predetermined characterological disposition nor the external authority of an accepted moral principle influences our conduct. The action is therefore neither a stereotyped one, which merely follows certain rules, nor is it one which we automatically perform in response to an external impulse, but it is an action determined purely and simply by its own ideal content. Such an action presupposes the capacity for moral intuitions. Whoever lacks the capacity to experience for himself the particular moral principle for each single situation will never achieve truly individual willing. Kant's principle of morality: act so that the basis of your action may be valid for all people, is the exact opposite of ours. His principle means death to all individual impulses of action. For me, the standard can never be the way all individuals would act, but rather what, for me, is to be done in each individual case. A superficial judgment might raise the following objection to these arguments. How can an action be individually made to fit the special case and the special situation, and yet at the same time be determined by intuition in a purely ideal way? The objection rests upon a confusion of the moral motive with the perceptible content of an action. The latter may be a motive, and actually is one in the case of the progress of civilization, or when we act from egoism, and so forth. But in an action based on pure moral intuition, it is not the motive. Of course, my eye takes notice of these perceptual contents, but it does not allow itself to be determined by them. The content is used only to construct a cognitive concept, but the corresponding moral concept is not derived by the eye from the object. The cognitive concept of a given situation facing me is at the same time a moral concept only if I take the standpoint of a particular moral principle. If I were to base my conduct only on the general principle of the development of civilization, then my way through life would be tied down to a fixed route. From every occurrence that I perceive and that concerns me, there springs at the same time a moral duty, namely, to do my little bit towards seeing that this occurrence is made to serve the development of civilization. In addition to the concept that reveals to me the connections of events or objects according to the laws of nature, there is also a moral label attached to them, which for me as a moral person gives ethical directions as to how I have to conduct myself. Such a moral label is justified on its own ground. At a higher level, it coincides with the idea that reveals itself to me when I am faced with a concrete instance. Human beings vary greatly in their capacity for intuition. In one, ideas just bubble up. Another acquires them with much labor. The situations in which people live and which provide the scenes of their actions are no less varied. The conduct of a person will therefore depend on the manner in which his faculty of intuition works in a given situation. The sum of ideas which are effective in us, the concrete content of our intuitions, constitutes what is individual in each of us, notwithstanding the universality of the world of ideas. Insofar as this intuitive content applies to action, it constitutes the moral content of the individual. To let this content express itself in life is both the highest moral driving force and the highest motive a person can have who sees that in this content all other moral principles are in the end united. We may call this point of view ethical individualism. The decisive factor of an intuitively determined action in any concrete instance is the discovery of the corresponding purely individual intuition. At this level of morality, one can only speak of general concepts of morality, (standards, laws, insofar as these result from the generalization of the individual impulses. General standards always presuppose concrete facts from which they can be derived. But the facts have first to be created by human action. I'm going to read those two sentences again. At this level of morality, one can only speak of general concepts of morality, standards, laws, insofar as these result from the generalization of the individual impulses. General standards always presuppose concrete facts from which they can be derived. But the facts have first to be created by human action. If we seek out the rules, conceptual principles, underlying the actions of individuals, peoples, and epochs, we obtain a system of ethics that is not so much a science of moral laws as a natural history of morality. It is only the laws obtained in this way that are related to human action, as the laws of nature are related to a particular phenomenon. These laws, however, are by no means identical with the impulses on which we base our actions. If we want to understand how a person's action arises from his moral will, we must first study the relation of this will to the action. Above all, we must keep our eye, E-Y-E, on those actions in which this relation is the determining factor. If I or someone else reflect upon such an action afterward, we can discover what moral principles come into question with regard to it. While I am performing the action, I am influenced by a moral maxim insofar as it can live in me intuitively. It is bound up with my love for the objective that I want to realize through my action. I ask no one, and no rule, quote, shall I perform this action, close quote, but carry it out as soon as I have grasped the idea of it. This alone makes it my action. If a person acts only because he accepts certain moral standards, his action is the outcome of the principles which compose his moral code. He merely carries out orders. He is a superior automaton. inject some stimulus to action into his mind, and at once the clockwork of his moral principles will set itself in motion and run its prescribed course, so as to result in an action which is Christian or humane or seemingly unselfish or calculated to promote the progress of civilization. Only when I follow my love for my objective is it I myself who act. I act at this level of morality not because I acknowledge a lord over me or an external authority or a so-called inner voice. I acknowledge no external principle of my action because I have found in myself the ground for my action, namely my love of the action. I do not work out mentally whether my action is good or bad. I carry it out because I love it. My action will be, in quotes, good, if my intuition, steeped in love, finds its right place within the intuitively experienceable world continuum. It will be, in quotes, bad, if this is not the case. Again, I do not ask myself, quote, how would another man act in my position, close quote. But I act as I, this particular individuality, find I have occasion to do. No general usage, no common custom, no maxim applying to all people, no moral standard is my immediate guide, but my love for the deed. I feel no compulsion, neither the compulsion of nature, which guides me by my instincts, nor the compulsion of the moral commandments. But I want simply to carry out what lies within me. Those who defend general moral standards might reply to these arguments that if everyone strives to live his own life and do what he pleases, there can be no distinction between a good deed and a crime. Every corrupt impulse that lies within me has as good a claim to express itself as has the intention of serving the general good. What determines me as a moral being cannot be the mere fact of my having conceived the idea of an action, but whether I judge it to be good or evil. Only in the former case should I carry it out. My reply to this very obvious objection, which is nevertheless based on a misapprehension of my argument, is this. If we want to understand the nature of the human will, we must distinguish between the path that leads this will to a certain degree of development and the unique character it assumes as it approaches this goal. On the path toward this goal, the standards play their rightful part. The goal consists of the realization of moral aims grasped by pure intuition. Man attains such aims to the extent that he is able to raise himself at all to the intuitive world of ideas. In any particular act of will, such moral aims will generally have other elements mixed in with them, either as driving force or as motive. Nevertheless, intuition may still be wholly or partly the determining factor in the human will. What one should do, one does. One provides the stage upon which obligation becomes deed. One's own action is what one brings forth from oneself. Here the impulse can only be wholly individual. And in truth, only an act of will that springs from intuition can be an individual one. To regard evil the deed of a criminal as an expression of the human individuality, in the same sense as one regards the embodiment of pure intuition, is only possible if blind instincts are reckoned as part of the human individuality. But the blind instinct that drives a person to crime does not spring from intuition, and does not belong to what is individual in him, but rather to what is most general in him, to what is equally present in all individuals, and out of which a person works his way by means of what is individual in him. What is individual in me is not my organism, with its instincts and its feelings, but rather the unified world of ideas, which lights up within this organism. My instincts, urges, and passions establish no more than that I belong to the general species, man. It is the fact that something of the idea world comes to expression in a particular way within these urges, passions, and feelings that establishes my individuality. Through my instincts and cravings, I am the sort of person of whom there are 12 to the dozen. Through the particular form of the idea, by means of which I designate myself within the dozen as I, capital, I am an individual. Only a being other than myself could distinguish me from others by the difference in my animal nature. Through my thinking, that is, by actively grasping what expresses itself in my organism as idea, I distinguish myself from others. Therefore, one cannot say of the action of a criminal that it proceeds from the idea within him. Indeed, the characteristic feature of criminal actions is precisely that they spring from the non-ideal elements in man. An action is felt to be free insofar as the reasons for it spring from the ideal part of my individual being. Every other part of an action, irrespective of whether it is carried out under the compulsion of nature or under the obligation of a moral standard, is felt to be unfree. A person is free insofar as he is able to obey himself in every moment of his life. A moral deed is my deed, only if it can be called a free one. In this sense, we have here considered what conditions are required for an intentional action to be felt as a free one. How this purely ethically understood idea of freedom comes to realization in the being of man will be shown in what follows. Acting out of freedom does not exclude the moral laws. It includes them, but shows itself to be on a higher level than those merely dictated by such laws. Why should my action be of less service to the public good when I have done it out of love than when I have done it only because I consider serving the public good to be my duty? The mere concept of duty excludes freedom, because it does not acknowledge the individual element, but demands that this be subject to a general standard. Freedom of action is conceivable only from the standpoint of ethical individualism. But how is a social life possible for human beings if each one is only striving to assert his own individuality? This objection is characteristic of a false understanding of moralism. Such a moralist believes that a social community is possible only if all people are united by a communally fixed moral order. What this kind of moralist does not understand is just the unity of the world of ideas. He does not see that the world of ideas working in me is no other than the one working in my fellow man. Admittedly, this unity is but an outcome of practical experience, but in fact it cannot be anything else. For if it could be known in any other way than by observation, then in its own sphere, universal standards rather than individual experience would be the rule. Individuality is possible only if every individual being knows of others through individual observation alone. I differ from my fellow man, not at all because we are living in two entirely different spiritual worlds, but because from the world of ideas common to us, both we receive different intuitions. I'm going to read that sentence again. I differ from my fellow man not at all because we are living in two entirely different spiritual worlds, but because from the world of ideas common to us both, we receive different intuitions. He wants to live out his intuitions. I, mine. If we both really conceive out of the idea and do not obey any external impulses, physical or spiritual, then we cannot but meet one another in like striving, in common intent. A moral understanding, a clash, is impossible between people who are morally free. Only the morally unfree, who follow their natural instincts or the accepted commands of duty, come into conflict with their neighbors, if these do not obey the same instincts and the same commands as themselves. To live in love toward our actions, and to let live in the understanding of the other person's will, is the fundamental maxim of free human beings. They know no other obligation than what their will puts itself in unison with intuitively, how they will direct their will in a particular case, their faculty for ideas will decide. Were the ability to get on with one another not a basic part of human nature, no external laws would be able to implant it in us. It is only because human individuals are one in spirit that they can live out their lives side by side. The free person lives in confidence that he and any other free individuals belong to one spiritual world, and that their intentions will harmonize. The free individual does not demand agreement from his fellow human beings, but expects to find it because it is inherent in human nature. I am not here referring to the necessity for this or that external institution, but to the disposition, the attitude of soul, through which a person aware of himself among his fellows most clearly expresses the ideal of human dignity. There are many who will say that the concept of the free man, which I have here developed, is a chimera, nowhere to be found in practice. We have to do with actual human beings, from whom we can only hope for morality if they obey some moral law. That is, if they regard their moral task as a duty and do not freely follow their inclinations and desires. I do not doubt this at all. Only a blind person could do so. But if this is to be the final conclusion, then away with all this hypocrisy about morality. Let us then simply say that human nature must be driven to its actions as long as it is not free. Whether a human being's unfreedom is forced on him by physical means or by moral laws, whether he is unfree because he follows his unlimited sexual desire or because he is bound by the fetters of conventional morality, is quite immaterial from a certain point of view. Only, let us not assert that such a person can rightly call his actions his own, seeing that he is driven to them by a force other than himself. But in the midst of all this framework of compulsion, there arise people who establish themselves as free spirits in all the welter of customs, legal codes, religious observances, and so forth. They are free in so far as they obey only themselves, unfree in so far as they submit to control. Which of us can say that he is really free in all his actions? Yet in each of us there dwells a deeper being in which the free man finds expression. Our life is made up of free and unfree actions. We cannot, however, think out the concept of man completely without coming upon the free spirit as the purest expression of human nature. Indeed, we are human beings in the true sense only in so far as we are free. This is an ideal, many will say, doubtless, but it is an ideal which is a real element in us, working its way to the surface of our nature. It is no ideal just thought up or dreamt, but one which has life, and which announces itself clearly even in the least perfect form of its existence. If man were merely a natural creature, there would be no such thing as the search for ideals, that is, for ideas which for the moment are not effective, but whose realization is required. With the things of the outer world, the idea is determined by the percept. We have done our share when we have recognized the connection between idea and percept. But with the human being it is not so. The sum total of his existence is not fully determined without his own self. His true concept as a moral being, (free spirit, is not objectively united from the start with the percept picture, man, needing only to be confirmed by knowledge afterward. A human being must unite his concept with the percept of man by his own activity. Reading that sentence again. A human being must unite his concept with the percept of man by his own activity. Concept and percept coincide in this case only if man himself makes them coincide. This he can do only if he has found the concept of the free spirit, that is, if he has found the concept of his own self. In the objective world, a dividing line is drawn by our organization between percept and concept. Knowledge overcomes this division. In our subjective nature, this division is no less present. Man overcomes it in the course of his development by bringing the concept of himself to expression in his outward existence. Hence, not only man's intellectual but also his moral life leads to his twofold nature, perceiving, direct experience, and thinking. The intellectual life overcomes this twofold nature by means of knowledge, the moral life overcomes it through the actual realization of the free spirit. Every existing thing has its inborn concept, parenthesis, the law of its being and doing, close parenthesis. But in external objects, this concept is indivisibly bound up with the percept, and separated from it only within our spiritual organization. In man, concept and percept are, at first, actually separated, to be just as actually united by him. One might object. At every moment of a person's life, there is a definite concept corresponding to our percept of him, just as with everything else. I can form for myself the concept of a particular type of man, and I may even find such a man given to me as a percept. If I now add to this the concept of a free spirit, then I have two concepts for the same object. Such an objection is one-sided. As object of perception, I am subjected to continual change. As a child, I was one thing. Another is a youth, yet another is a man. Indeed, at every moment, the percept picture of myself is different from what it was the moment before. These changes may take place in such a way that it is always the same man, parenthesis, the type, close parenthesis, who reveals himself in them, or that they represent the expression of a free spirit. To such changes, my action as object of perception is subjected. The perceptual object, man, has in it the possibility of transforming itself, just as the plant seed contains the possibility of becoming a complete plant. The plant transforms itself because of the objective law inherent in it. The human being remains in his incomplete state unless he takes hold of the material for transformation within him and transforms himself through his own power. Nature makes of man merely a natural being. Society makes of him a law-abiding being. Only he himself can make of himself a free person. Nature releases the human being from her fetters at a definite stage in his development. Society carries this development a stage further. He alone can give himself the final polish. The standpoint of free morality, then, does not declare the free spirit to be the only form in which a human being can exist. It sees in the free spirit only the last stage of man's evolution. This is not to deny that conduct according to standards has its justification as one stage in evolution. Only, we cannot acknowledge it as the absolute standpoint in morality. For the free spirit overcomes the standards in the sense that he does not just accept commandments as his motives, but orders his action according to his own impulses, parenthesis, intuitions, close parenthesis. When Kant says of duty, quote, "Duty, thou exalted and mighty name, thou that dost comprise nothing lovable, nothing ingratiating, but demandest submission, thou that settest up a law, before which all inclinations are silent, even though they secretly work against it," close quote. Then, out of the consciousness of the free spirit, man replies, quote, "Freedom, thou kindly and human name, thou that dost comprise all that is morally most lovable, all that my humanity most prizes, and that makest me the servant of nobody, thou that settest up no mere law, but awaitest what my moral love itself will recognize as law, because in the face of every merely imposed law, it feels itself unfree. Close quote. This is the contrast between a morality based on mere law and a morality based on inner freedom. The Philistine who sees the embodiment of morality in an external code may see in the free spirit even a dangerous person, but that is only because his view is narrowed down to a limited period of time. If he were able to look beyond this, he would at once find that the free spirit just as seldom needs to go beyond the laws of his state as does the Philistine himself, and certainly never needs to place himself in real opposition to them. For the laws of the state, one and all, just like all other objective laws of morality, have had their origin in the intuitions of free spirits. There is no rule enforced by family authority that was not at one time intuitively grasped and laid down as such by an ancestor. Similarly, the conventional laws of morality are first of all established by definite individuals, and the laws of the state always originate in the head of a statesman. These leading spirits have set up laws over other people, and the only person who feels unfree is the one who forgets this origin, and either turns these laws into extra-human commandments, objective moral concepts of duty independent of man, or else turns them into the commanding voice within himself, which he supposes in a falsely mystical way to be compelling him. On the other hand, the person who does not overlook this origin, but seeks man within it, will count such laws as belonging to the same world of ideas from which he, too, draws his moral intuitions. If he believes he has better intuitions, he will try to put them into the place of the existing ones. If he finds the existing ones justified, he will act in accordance with them as if they were his own. We must not coin the formula, man exists only in order to realize a moral world order which is quite distinct from himself. Anyone who maintains that this is so remains in his knowledge of man at the point where natural science stood when it believed that a bull has horns in order to butt. Scientists, happily, have thrown out the concept of purpose as a dead theory. Ethics finds it more difficult to get free of this concept. But just as horns do not exist for the sake of butting, but butting through the presence of horns, so man does not exist for the sake of morality, but morality through the presence of man. The free person acts morally because he has a moral idea. He does not act in order that morality may come into being. Human individuals with the moral ideas belonging to their nature are the prerequisites of a moral world order. The human individual is the source of all morality and the center of earthly life. State and society exist only because they have arisen as a necessary consequence of the life of individuals. That state and society should in turn react upon individual life is no more difficult to comprehend than that the butting, which is the result of the presence of horns, reacts in turn upon the further development of the horns of the bull, which would become stunted through prolonged disuse. Similarly, the individual would become stunted if he led an isolated existence outside human society. Indeed, this is just why the social order arises, so that it may in turn react favorably upon the individual. The end of chapter 9.